I have Jane Reichold as my guest on Sunday Afternoon Jazz and Standards. Jane is lives locally, but actually translates and writes poetry internationally. I'm finding out more about Jane's prowess as a haiku expert on the international scene, not just on the local scene. And Haiku Jane, hi.
Yes, thank you.
Are you still putting articles in the ICO? Yeah. I mean haikus?
Oh, yes, every week.
Every week. I shouldn't ask.
Right.
I should know.
Right, you should look.
I should look and read them. And how many do you usually put in? How many years have you been doing Haiku Jane in the ICO?
I think since 1992.
Since 92, you put one a week in, huh?
Mm-hmm. I usually put them all together over the holidays, and so the whole year is submitted at once. So they have them on storage and put them in one at a week.
And are they recently written?
Usually the year before.
From the year before.
Mm-hmm.
I want to bring Jane on today, or I am bringing Jane on today because of the haiku celebration, a launch at the book Basho, The Complete Haiku by Jane Reichold, the introduction. It says here Basho, The Complete Haiku by Jane Reichold.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
That means I did the introduction, the preface, the translation, the notes, so everything but what Basho did.
So it's your book, except it's Basho's haiku.
Right.
And who is Basho?
Basho is sometimes called the saint of haiku. He was actually canonized by the Shinto religion and also by the imperial household about 100 years after he died. So he is the saint of haiku, and that's interesting because when he lived, he wasn't known for his haiku. He was a renga master. Renga is another poetry form, and that's where he was famous for, or his renga. But then later, he became famous then for his single verses.
Renga is what?
Renga is a linked verse poetry form that was famous and popular from about 1000 to 1400. And then it slowly receded until the beginning of the 1900s. Shiki, the most famous poet in Japan, said that no one should write renga anymore. But there's still some of us who do.
Again, what century was Basho?
Basho lived from 1644 to 1694.
And is that his full name, or what?
Actually, he has several names. There was the name that he was given when he was born, the name he had as a young child, the name he had when he first started to write. And this was only after he went to Tokyo to be a renga master that a bunch of his disciples, students, built a little, they called it a hut, basically a little cottage on the river, and some man, one of his students, gave him a banana plant, and banana in Japanese is basho.
I see.
And so he took his name from.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. You know all this stuff, huh? I'm talking to Jane Reichold, haiku poet and translator as well. Talk about your translating.
This is my fifth book of translation, and everyone wants to know, do you speak Japanese? And I don't. But I do use a native speaker, and they give me the poem that I'm working with in Romaji, which is the romanized letters for the kanji. And from that, I can recognize what the words are. I have sort of a 400-year-old poetic vocabulary. So,
you keep saying, what is the term you keep using, kanji?
Kanji, those, you've seen like the Chinese writing, you mm-hmm. know, with the nice fancy. That's what, well, actually, Japan has three different ways of doing that. There's the old Chinese way, then there's two other ways. And I've tried to learn those at various times, but I think I'm too old to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and Haiku Celebration next Saturday, October 11th at 4 p.m. at the infamous, famous, and never-ending, well, that used to be Jack's, Farm Never-Ending, but Four Eyed Frog Bookstore Never-Ending, Jeremy and Joel upstairs in the Cypress Village. Jane will give a short history of Basho's life, tell how the book came to be, and read some of Basho's best poems. There will also be time for her to answer any questions you have about haiku. I think this is going to be really well attended, Jane.
Hope so.
Bring your latest haiku to share with others. Refreshments will be served. Also special for the event, with each purchase of Basho, The Complete Haiku, a copy of 10 years Haiku Jane. A copy of 10 Years Haiku Jane, a $12 value, will be included. Let me say that again. With each purchase of Basho, which Jane's going to read from in a moment, the complete haiku, a copy of 10 Years Haiku Jane, a $12 value, will be included. And there it is right here, 10 Years of Haiku Jane, Jane Reichold. And that's next Saturday at the Four Eyed Frog Bookstore, and that's why we're doing this piece today. I'm very impressed. People love haiku, and I've always loved it since I was a teenager. And I always thought it was, I was told, there was a man on the radio back in the 1950s, the late 50s, Gene Shepherd, who was actually the man who made that very beloved movie, The Christmas Story. And he narrates that, and he created that beloved film. But he was a great radio personality, raconteur, and all-around brilliant genius on the radio. And he used to read haiku on the air in about 1957, 58, right in there when I was a teenager. And he used to stay up at night, and he'd play koto music behind his haiku, and he'd read from Basho. And he used to say that it was absolutely 17-syllable poetry. And you've straightened me out on that. You want to talk to me about that, Jane Reichold?
Okay, I can explain it, I think. In Japanese, they use 17 sound units, and that's where everyone gets the idea that we should use 17 syllables. But sound units are much shorter than our syllables. So if we wrote a poem with 17 English syllables, it has about a third too much information in it. So we've sort of backed off of having people do 5, 7, 5 syllables, because you just get something that's not very Japanese and not very haiku-like.
So what you're saying is that in Japanese it would have 17, what do you call them?
Sound units.
Sound units. And it was misconstrued that in translation it would have to have 17 syllables in English.
Right.
But what Gene Shepherd used to point out, or when we'd count the syllables,
right,
it would be 17. So right, the translations were erroneously trying to do that. Is
right,
that is that
That's
accurate?
Exactly right, yes. They even tried many different things to make haiku into English poetry. They tried to rhyme it, which it mostly doesn't in English. They tried to add different line lengths, and all sorts of experiments have been done. There's the most famous one by Basho. It's Old Pond. A frog jumps into the sound of water. And there are almost... There's a book of over 100 translations of this. People worked and worked and worked trying to find out how to bring what it said in Japanese to what it could say in English. And my discovery is, if you just go back and translate the Japanese as simply and as concisely and as accurately as you can, the poem will come across.
The poem will come across. Now, back to this 17th syllable, because I really want to totally... I think I'm grasping... I mean, getting it now. It's because I said it back to you correctly. But the lovely... Who was the publisher of those lovely little haiku books?
Those are the Peter Pauper series.
Peter Pauper series, and that's what I used to buy when I was in Greenwich Village when I was 17, 16.
That's what I discovered haiku in. Yes.
And they were charming and lovely and
beautiful,
and wood carvings.
Yes,
I think.
down the sides.
And that's what Gene Shepherd, I think, read from. And then I would buy the koto music at the store on Fifth Avenue and go home and read from the Peter Pauper Press books and try to do what Shepherd was doing, called him Shep. But I would count the syllables, and they were 17.
Yes.
And I was always fascinated by that, and I thought it had to be. And so the question becomes then, since you're a prominent translator now, and you're not doing 17-syllable translations into English, were those translators misinformed or ignorant, or what? Why were they putting it out with 17 English syllables?
Well, there were many reasons. One reason was the Japanese people feel so strongly that there needed to be 17 parts that they closed their eyes to the idea that our syllables were different. The other thing is most people who translate Japanese are scholars. And in fact, as far as I know, I'm the first haiku poet who has done translations. So I do it from a completely different feeling and look for result than they did.
And do you, and I haven't read everything you've written in your preface and so forth, but do you talk about this 17-syllable phenomenon so people don't look at your translations and erroneously criticize, again, erroneously?
Oh, that doesn't bother me.
Wouldn't you want them to know?
Well,
why it isn't 17, because they would look and say, well, this isn't right. And that, you know, and that's a big deal. It was a big deal.
I know. It's a far too large of issue for haiku. And I think everybody who learned haiku in kindergarten or grade school, they all learned it had to have 17
that's
syllables.
Right.
And there are still people who say it isn't a haiku if it doesn't have 17
that's
syllables.
Right. That's right.
But if... You know, it's sort of like you can either have the product or the process. If you want the product, then you have to use less than 17 syllables. If you want the process, you can write English 17 syllables. And some people do, and there are excellent haiku like that.
But do you educate around this area?
Oh, yes, yes.
Quite often, so that people aren't thinking that isn't pure.
This isn't a surprise.
It is pure, but they're thinking it isn't pure, so you want to educate them is the point.
I think most people who really study haiku, and it's amazing that you really have to study such a small, simple form.
Yeah.
And they know now. I published a book in 1992, Writing and Enjoying Haiku, and in there I explain that fully.
And do you in the introduction to the Bashu book?
Oh, I think I may say a little bit about it because it's an issue
ongoing. It is an issue. It's going to be ongoing.
Mm-hmm,
Now, what is it, aside from the syllables, now get off that, because really that's got to be kind of like disengaged from the brain, you know, before you can go on. And, you know, that it's a big, because it's so drummed in, you know,
right,
in, and that's, you know, one of the charms of it in a way. And it takes, you know, like, oh my God, how did he do that? And how did he do that in 17 syllables? And I used to wonder about how they would translate and get it into the same amount of syllables. But getting away from that now, what goes into creating a haiku in your mind?
Well, from my study of Basho's work, I figured out that there are techniques that he was using, and he had various ways of writing his haiku and using these techniques. And this has been very helpful when I'm translating, because, you know, when you translate a word, it can have five or six different meanings. But if you know where he was taking his haiku, where it was going to go, what he was doing with it, then you can pick the best English word.
But aside from translation, you write haiku on your own.
Oh, yes, for years.
So that's what I'm asking. What goes into writing a haiku from your perspective?
Oh. Well, you know, there's 100 rules and 1,000 different ways of doing it, and the very early way was to say, if you observe something in nature and you fully took it in and you didn't do anything to it, you just brought it right back out, you would have a haiku moment and you would have a good haiku.
That's good. Is it always nature?
Basically, and in fact, it was just a few years ago that they acknowledged that humans are nature too. Mm-hmm. They thought there was they put a wall between nature and human nature.
Do all your haikus involve nature?
No.
They don't have to. There's no rule about that.
All the rules are there to be broken.
But aside from being a rebel and breaking rules, is there a rule to that effect?
Oh, yes.
There is.
Someone has that rule, yes.
As a Japanese rule?
Yes. Well, even in English, yes.
It is?
Yes.
But so where do those rules get written? I mean, where do they come up?
It's interesting that the people who are attracted to haiku are often people who need discipline in their lives. And one of the ways of bringing this discipline is the right rules for haiku.
So you don't buy it? Is that what you
Well, no, I listen to it. In fact, I have a website where I teach haiku. And on there is an article, I think it's called Haiku Rules, and there are 76 rules for haiku.
At least there aren't the erroneous 17. 76 rules for haiku?
67, I think it is.
It's a very anal... I mean, what's the deal there?
It's everybody gets it in their hands and they want to control it.
You said 76 or 67?
I think it's 67. I may have misspoke.
Yeah, one or the other, but they're from... some of them are from the ancient, you know, from the Japanese, the traditional.
Sure, sure.
And then others were added?
Yes, because there have been people, Japanese people, who've tried to teach us how to write haiku, and they bring their rules with them.
Do you think that's, I mean, it's such a lovely impressionistic art form, poetry form. Why would you say that people have become so anal about how it has to be done. It's because what it conveys is the opposite of being anal.
But it's sort of like the artless art, where you have to really study and work and work and work to be able to turn up something that simple.
So therefore you have to be rigidly given
no,
doctrine, well, and dogma and...
I hope I'm not those things.
You're not. You're defying that. But I'm talking about the rules that you want to break.
There's rule givers and there's rule breakers.
Right, but why are so many rule givers involved with such a lovely impressionistic art form? That's what I mean.
That also happens in all the Japanese poetry forms.
Oh, okay. It's not special.
No,
Haiku.
No. It's well learned from them.
So maybe it's a proclivity of the Japanese, which I never thought was true.
It is.
They
is.
Have a lot of. Oh, yeah. That's why they kill themselves when the CEOs.
Over the bad haiku.
Yeah. Well, the CEOs when they fail, they kill themselves. Here they go off with $15 million
parachutes.
Yeah, it's a different culture.
Right.
Different.
Right,
they take things
right,
too very
right,
seriously.
Right.
They internalize. Okay, you want to read from your own haiku or from Basho?
Oh, I had planned to read from Basho.
No.
Just a few of his most famous
yeah.
ones because.
Yeah. And do you have your own here too that we could? Yeah, right
yeah,
in front.
Right here.
Let's do both. Let's. Yeah.
You can pick something. While
no,
I read.
I can't do that. I want to listen.
Okay.
So. Okay.
We'll have a little fight here, huh?
Well, I don't want to be reading your haiku while you're reading Basho's haiku. That wouldn't...
You could have a cultural shock there.
That wouldn't do.
Okay. When Basho was a young man, he accidentally, it almost seems, he wrote a very beautiful haiku that has become one of his most famous ones. And it is, and many of you may already know it, "On a bare branch, a crow settled down. Autumn evening." And... Basho breaks one of his own rules here, because most haiku are written in the present tense because they're supposed to feel to the reader like they're happening now. And yet he wrote this one in the past tense and it became famous. And in fact, when I was doing the book, my editor went over it and he looked at it and he said, "But you've got this one in the past tense and you shouldn't have it." And I had to say, "Well, Basho wrote it in the past tense. We got to keep it."
Back to the rules.
Yep. So those are two of Basho's. That and "The Frog Jumped In" are his most famous ones.
Okay, go ahead.
Another famous one is "An Octopus Jar, the Short-Lived Dreams of the Summer Moon." An octopus jar, the short-lived dreams of the summer moon. And I don't know if you know about octopus catching in Japan, but they had earthenware jars. And when you look in that jar, and if there are octopi in there, they look like moons, like white moons floating
okay,
in the water.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
It would have been better if you said that before you read it.
Oh, you won't.
Then we'd understand it. Now I got to think back what it said, see.
Well.
That's okay. Go ahead. We'll go do another one.
Go another one?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just sticking with his most famous ones because,
yeah.
Yes, anyhow. Basho made his famous journey to the north called, has many different titles, Backroads to the Far North, Backroads to the Far Providences. And what he did, he took a journey, was over 1,500 miles walking on horseback. And he would stop at famous places and sit there and write haiku. And he was at a castle that had now completely disintegrated, and you could only tell by the landform that there had been a castle there. And he wrote, "Summer grass, the only remains of soldiers, dreams. Summer grass, the only remains of soldiers, dreams."
But his haiku was not repeated. You repeated.
I repeated
yeah,
it
yeah.
because it's
sure.
You can add different inference to it. You know, the remains of the soldiers are the remains of the dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And yes.
Okay.
So that was.
Want to read some more?
Well.
Read a few more. Yeah.
Read more.
Please, yeah.
A cuckoo, in a bamboo thicket, leaking moonlight.
A cuckoo in a bamboo thicket.
Leaking
moonlight.
Right. So you don't know, is is the image of the koku the leak of moonlight, or is it just the moonlight coming through? It could be a bird, or it could be moonlight. And haiku often does this to make things so that as you think about them, they begin to revolve and reveal new meanings. And
are they meant to be symbolic in most cases?
That's a good argument. Some people will argue that they never should, and then other people like to have what they call multi-layered haiku, so that you can keep reading it and finding new things behind.
Some people would argue that they never should?
Right, right. Shiki was the most famous one. He said, you should only describe what you see with nothing else. No wordplay, no deeper meaning, nothing. Just describe it.
And on the other hand?
On the other hand, I believe that when you look at something and you let it touch you deep within, it's going to raise up memories, metaphors, other things that you want to think about, and it all comes together then, and it can be rich.
Would you contend that you could consciously be creating metaphors and symbols, or that it would be implied and unconscious?
A haiku often goes through many rewrites, and so you can start out with just the sketch idea, just what it is, and then as you think about it, you can think, oh, that word means something else. And, you know, English is great because there are so many meanings to a word, and many of our words can be both a verb and a noun. So you can put the word, like, leaves in, and it can either mean the things falling off the tree or something going away. So you can get double mileage out of your haiku that way.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think. There's another language, though, that gosh, I wish I could. That besides English, that's very rich in abstraction and double meaning. And
well, Japanese is. And in fact, they think their language is the best one for writing haiku. Mm-hmm. But it's often because they don't recognize that English is also a very rich language.
Really, I didn't think that it was actually.
Well, I think we have more words than any other language.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, but then in other languages there is that deeper meaning to one word. It could mean many different things.
Right, and the Japanese has the advantage of, we talked about the kanji, the symbol, like the Chinese symbol. Those all have meanings, and they have root meanings, radical meanings. And so their language is very rich.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Please read more basho.
Day after day, barley ripens, a singing skylark. I think here he's working with the idea. One of the things is have things that associate. And so day after day, the barley ripens, and day after day, a singing skylark. These two things happen day after day. And so that fits perfectly into haiku thinking.
I'd be interested, actually, in but I don't think we have that here, some of the previous translations from the Peter Pauper Press of these same ones and how they were written.
They were written, like you said, to do the 5-7-5 to make the 17. And so he would pad them out.
Mm.
And that's the thing that people hold against the 17-syllable idea, is the poem is all padded up with English words that, I mean, this is enough for you to understand what's
mm-hmm.
going on.
Yeah, but we don't have it side by side so we can compare.
I'll bring it another time.
I would be very
want.
Interested in that because it's a little, one has to get used to this new, more authentic way without the 17 syllables.
Right,
I'm used to the padded ones,
right,
as you call them.
Right.
These
right.
end more quickly. They ended pretty quickly before with the 17. Now they're ending, I just counted, that was about 12 syllables.
Right,
you know.
12 syllables is the right number.
Oh, wait a minute. Now you're telling me it's to 12?
Well, I was saying if you did 17 syllables, it'd be about one-third too much. So if I only have 12 syllables, that means I cut off one-third
of
the syllables.
But doesn't have to now be 12.
No.
That's what I thought you were saying.
No, but it's a way of checking, am I right with this?
Yeah, but it could be 11 or 10 or 13 or 14.
Certainly.
I thought we were back in the rigidity now. Now it's not 17, it's 12, yeah. Read about two more of basho and then three or so of your own. please.
So many of his are hooked in with things he was doing or where he was traveling, and so there's notes in the book. There's a whole fact. There's about as many pages given to the notes as to the poems. Here's one written after a friend of his died. The moon disappears. Afterward, the desk has four corners.
Now, why are you, since all of them are excellent, being so selective? I mean, you're flipping the pages to find just the right one, and there's four or six on each page. what's guiding you to these specific ones?
Because some are harder to understand, and many of them do need the notes to understand the situation he was in, or to explain the custom mm-hmm. that's behind the poem.
Because I recall in the Peter Pauper Press that they were all just nature images.
Yes. But those were greatly selected, and in fact, up until now, people felt, or said even, that Basho's poems were not worth translating all of them. And I disagreed with that, because I felt he was a genius. And we want to look at everything the man did.
Mm-hmm.
His good moments and his bad moments.
Okay. Please find one of a very strong image of nature, you know, pool reflections, frogs chirping. Those are the ones that always resonated with me, if you can.
Well, here's one for the autumn, sort of like our kind of autumn. And often Basho put a few words at the beginning of them called a preface. And this one he prefaces with lingering summer heat. Still summer, the harvest moon too hot to enjoy the coolness.
Okay, now please read that one again.
Okay. Still summer, the harvest moon too hot to enjoy the coolness.
Oh, that's nice, yeah. You have to really think of it.
Yeah.
Okay, now it's time for Haiku Jane to read. Oh. Jane Reichold to read from her own Haiku Jane. What is the name of this book?
10 Years Haiku Jane. These were 10 years of the poems that were published in the ICO. And in fact, the last year in the book is this present year. So you can read in the book and in the ICO at the same time.
Okay, just pick one arbitrarily. Don't be so selective.
Okay.
They're all good, I'm sure. Or you wouldn't put them in there.
A morning moon lining up the planets. I dream of beads.
Okay, that's a morning moon lining up the planets. I dream of beads.
Right, and that shows very clearly the two parts of a haiku. A haiku has a fragment and a phrase. A morning moon lining up the planets is the phrase, and then the fragment is I dream of beads.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of beads, the rattle you may hear is every time Jane moves her head, you hear her earrings, which are made of beads and... You hear them? I can hear it in the...
You can hear them.
Oh, yeah, it's coming
sorry.
Out in, through the mic, yeah. So that's very
off.
Appropriate. I was going to say maybe we should take them up, but it's perfect for the poem.
Okay,
so that's the
works.
Background
that
sound.
That works.
Yeah. What else?
I'll just go down the page
here. Just
I'm
you?
Not so...
No, they're
picky.
All good. They're all...
Without a boat crossing the creek, pine shadow wind. This is using the technique of a riddle. What can cross the creek without a boat? And the answer is pine shadow wind.
Hmm. Now, how did you write that? How do you do that? What made you do that?
I was up in Annapolis, and I often travel to places that are different to me because that sort of unblocks the haiku and they start rolling out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at this little creek, and the wind came across the creek, and it just struck me that the wind didn't need a boat. I would have. But,
And then did you write it right on the spot there?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And exactly as it appears now?
I don't know. I would have to check back. It could be that, yes.
But you do basically, you do write a haiku right there.
Oh, yes.
Whether it's
yes.
the actual haiku you end up with, it's a haiku.
It's a haiku, yes.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'll change them, sometimes not. And, the next one is Swollen Hands, Unfolding After Prayer. Chrysanthemums. And this is the idea of association, that the chrysanthemum looks like a swollen hand, And you know how when hands are folded in prayer, they're locked fingers? And as you open that, that looks like a chrysanthemum.
The round, usually white or yellow, big chrysanthemum.
Right, right. And that's the whole basis for that poem.
Interesting. And now are you thinking of multi-layered symbolism or imagery or metaphor, or are you just putting out impressions?
In the beginning, it's simply observation.
Is observation.
Yes, and then it's only with revision that I begin to think, oh, I could add this if I changed that word, and then I do that.
Now the commonly when people analyze poetry or in poetry appreciation classes, it's all about what is the real meaning of what is behind that and what is the symbolism, and you can go crazy when you're in school with that, with a teacher just making you think that way and trying to understand it. A lot of poetry is just beautiful to listen to, but difficult to understand. I've talked to Blake Moore about that. She says it doesn't always matter if you understand it; it's just to hear it, which sort of took the pressure off me, because I don't always understand it. And I don't even mean just the symbolism of it, but just even what it's saying. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons I've always loved haiku is, it's not that it's you receive something very definite right away. It's not all about analyzing it or trying to understand the convoluted words of the poet.
And that's the beauty of haiku for other people, because people think that poets are, born or have some special thing, but I really think anyone can be a poet. And haiku is an excellent gateway genre. You can do a haiku in, just minutes. It can come to you. And you have the right to feel like a poet then.
Mm.
And that's why it's taught in the schools. That's why many older poets, like Rilke and Richard Wright.
Saturday at the Four-Eyed Frog Bookstore at 4 o'clock, discussing haiku and reading haiku next Saturday, October 11th. Jane, I'm still fascinated by this idea of imagery and metaphor. Now, there's no way that when one hears one of these haikus, that one can stop oneself from thinking of it on deeper levels. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes, yes. That's totally the way it should be. In fact, that's the marvelousness of haiku, because it is so short. You can remember it. Most people can. Mm-hmm. I have a hard time remembering haiku.
Mm, really?
Especially my own.
Really?
But
or as I've been doing, you can just say it back right away.
Mm-hmm,
your retentiveness of the brain will hold the few sentences.
Right, right.
And so you can start to ponder it very immediately as what it means to you, or how it relates to your life, or feelings about life, or attitudes.
The other thing is, say you're taking a walk, and your idea is to try and find haiku out there. And so you walk along and you think, how will I know that there's haiku material here? And the moment you feel, oh, look at that, and you would like to say to someone else, look at that. Did you notice how spiky the thistle is? That's the beginning. The
sure.
universe is starting it for you.
Sure.
And then you begin to think about this. And as you walk along, it'll just come to you.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Read two more, please, and then we'll say goodbye. These are Jane's own haiku, Haiku Jane.
A spider's web hanging in the wind chime, sunset colors. This is the idea that...
Says, read it one more time.
Okay.
A spider's web hanging in the wind chimes, sunset colors.
Right. Thank you.
Now, why is that... why is Basho's any better than that? If he's the master and you're not, but you're
Oh, wow, are you in dangerous territory?
Well, maybe you are, and that's the question.
I would say that the haiku being written in English are already in many ways superior to what he was writing.
Why?
And may lightning not strike me.
Well, that's pretty blasphemous, but luckily we don't have a big intellectual Japanese community up here on the South Coast.
We'll be getting telephone calls.
But in Japanese. But why do you say that, Jane?
Well, you have to think about the society that Basho lived in. It was 400 years ago. And we have so much more education, knowledge, we know more about, and there's also been 400 years of haiku have been written that we have studied and learned from. So we have all these advantages he didn't have.
But that's as if to say, and I'll relate it to jazz, and this won't, that Louis Armstrong was, you know, one of the original creators of jazz and the art form and the language, and he's still to this day the master. It doesn't matter what comes after him. Louis Armstrong is still the master. So that would normally not apply. That actually over time, an art form can get bastardized or watered down as a rule. It was the master who was the pure form.
And this happened in Japan. When Basho died, he left about 70 disciples, and the form immediately went into a decline. And it was only about 100 years later that the master, Buzen, was working. He was a painter and a haiku writer. And he revitalized the form, and it came back a little bit. And then when he died, again, it sunk into oblivion almost. And yes.
And then you came along.
No.
Well, that's what you're leading me to believe.
I'm sorry, that's not true. No. But the fact is that since haiku has been brought out of Japan,
mm-hmm.
There's been many people who worked very hard at studying it, figuring out what Basho did, what the other old masters did,
mm-hmm.
and, yes, using it.
Okay. I could keep asking along these lines, but I'm that way. But keep, no, read two more, please, of your own.
Well, this is one that was written in City Art Gallery. Sunday afternoon, the sun moves out of the art gallery.
Okay.
And from the dream of rowing the river, blisters.
One or two more.
The river way, a canoe divides sunshine. Big river looks even larger in a boat. Canoe silence. Floating down the river, something silk.
Okay, those are all Jane Reichholz's poetry. What is the name of that book? 10 Years of Haiku Jane. And, boy, it is taking me a while to get used to the non-padded form. You
Good.
Know, the flow
I'm glad
of the
you're getting used to it, though.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you get that a lot with people when people talk about that? That
yes,
used
yes,
to,
yes, yeah, yes. Yeah. I've been working with the Ukiah Haiku Festival.
Yeah.
And there were people there, teachers,
yeah.
who believed in 575,
yeah.
and they have a hard time.
They have a hard time. And I'm glad you mentioned Ukiah, because I read when I was reading your preface today that to the Basho book that haiku is that Ukiah is haiku spelled backwards. Now,
yes.
is that intentional?
No, I think Ukiah is a Pomo word.
I see.
And it just happened to be. Right. So now they have a festival. I think it's in its fourth or fifth year, the last weekend of April. And they do big contests, and people come together and share haiku. Oh,
I see. Okay. They played off of the fact that the
yeah,
Pomo
they're using there. That.
Okay. One more time, the haiku celebration to launch of the book Basho, the Complete Haiku by Jane Reichholz at the Four-Eyed Frog Bookstore. Next Saturday, October 11th at 4 p.m. Special for this event, with each purchase of Haiku, the Complete Haiku, I'm sorry, with each purchase of Basho, the Complete Haiku, a copy of 10 Years Haiku Jane, a $12 value will be included.
It's something I didn't talk about is how special haiku is to Walala and how Walala is special to haiku.
How so?
Because we have a lot of haiku writers here. Walala, for its size, and even beyond considering that, has done so much to add to haiku literature. We did, Walala Arts used to have a group, and there were two books published through that of local people's work. No one else has done that. And one of the very first anthologies came out of Los Altos in San Francisco Bay Area. And one of the women who was in that book, the very first anthology of haiku in America, Margaret Bullock, lives up here in Walala.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, well, perhaps in April we'll bring all the haiku writers together and
yes,
have
yes.
some Japanese music at the
right.
Art Center. We'll look into that for the poetry and
right.
jazz event
Good.
This year.
And
in April we'll consider that. Thank you, Jane Reichholz. for coming on with me. I've never had a live interview on this show before, so first. Thanks, Jane.
Thank you.